Yesterday and today, we're thinking together about economic power, or the power of corporations, or monopoly power, or I'm not sure just what it is. We're thinking about something that bothers a lot of Americans, something that expresses itself in the form of alarm about the growing power of corporations. That's the usual phrase that sort of roughly describes this phenomenon. The principal thing that I tried to do yesterday was get you to think about market power. That is, the power of sellers. I tried to convince you that it's always a matter of degree, that any particular seller will have more power over you. The poorer the range of substitutes that you have when you face him. And you mentioned a lot of people here goods or sellers or industries which might or might not have substantial market power. And we did some talking, exploring how much power do they have. And I thought it was a valuable exercise. I think when you get people thinking about their own experience, using just a few elementary principles to put that experience together, they learn a good deal more than when somebody stands and tells them. So I'd like you to do some more thinking today, but I want to sort of shift it. Let me ask three questions. The first question is the one we were talking about yesterday, and I don't plan to talk about it today, but the question that emerged, I think, at the end of the session yesterday was, all right, how serious a problem is market power or monopoly power in the American economy? Is it true that the American economy is dominated by firms that have so much market power that they can charge prices way above costs, thereby appropriating for themselves large profits? Are we at the mercy? That always means somewhat at the mercy of large corporations. Is the economy becoming more monopolistic, more dominated by market power? But actually, that's the second question. Are things getting worse? Was there a time, you sometimes hear this statement, well, back in the 19th century, when the economy was competitive, that may have worked out, but that's no longer true today. Today, the economy is dominated by monopolies and oligopolies. All right, has the situation gotten worse, maybe since 1900? Is it getting worse right now? Are we going somewhere we don't want to go? And then the third question is, are there other forms of corporate power or economic power about which we ought to be concerned? And here I'm going to rely on you to tell me about them. What are the other forms of economic power with which you are concerned and with which you think the public ought to be concerned and about which government ought to be concerned? But before raising that question, let me go back to this, the first two. Is the problem of market power a major one? And what we were talking about yesterday, do all sorts of sellers have us by the throat? Now, I think that's a question that's impossible to answer. There have been some empirical studies by economists that tried to measure the degree of market power in the economy as a whole. I think they're instructive for people who take them with a huge grain of salt. And I might add that the net result of these was to minimize the importance of market power. However, I don't think that those studies have convinced anyone who wasn't convinced beforehand. Some of the economists who have made these studies, Warren Nutter, A.C. Harberger, George Stigler, all of them associated in one way or another with Al Pitcher's school. They either got their degrees there or have taught there or are teaching there. They have come to the conclusion that the extent of business monopoly in the United States in the last couple of decades, I mean, they always have to go back into the past in order to measure. Data aren't available for last year yet, not good data, not adequate data. And these people have minimized it. They think that the problem is way overblown. But now I want to stress that the people like John Kenneth Galbraith or John Blair, and there's no point in mentioning names because you wouldn't be familiar with them anyway, but a large number of other economists who think that the monopoly problem is serious have criticized, rather severely criticized, the methodology of these studies and they don't think that they measure what they purport to measure. I think that a much more answerable question is not, is the situation terrible? How terrible is it? But rather, has it gotten worse?
That I would like to ask is why, if indeed it's a nebulous point to prove, why is it that it seems to so many people that it's gotten worse? What are the factors and what are the things that we feel paranoia about, if that's what it is, that we think that this is what's happening? Is it our own problem? Or any one of a million reasons? That's maybe what we
I think that's a very good question, and Let's come back to that, huh? Can you hold it? Be sure we do come back to it. It's now 5 minutes to 11, and be sure we come back to it by at least 11:30. So, all right? If it's 11:30 and I've forgotten, you jump in and say it's time. Because I think that's an important question. Now, I'm not assuming that it's paranoia. I'm assuming that there is something in the world, something in our social reality, which causes people to come to the conclusion, as I know that the majority of Americans have, that we are increasingly at the mercy of powerful business groups that are doing something that... Now, why is that? What are those realities? But I'd like to go back to this question. It's a very simple question. Has the problem gotten worse? Was there a semi-golden age, 12 carat anyway, when... the economy was fairly competitive. You know, when some of those things that were mentioned yesterday weren't occurring. Business firms didn't produce products that they deliberately made so they'd wear out in 2 years. Or when you got value for the value you paid. Was the economy once competitive, or reasonably competitive, but it is no longer? Or were corporations once smaller? Now they're enormous. Were they once so many that they couldn't collude and combine? And now they've all gotten so few through mergers that...
Certain industries or certain areas have gotten quite a bit less competitive. And the one I'm thinking of is the air conditioning business, where there used to be maybe 12 or 1400 firms that manufactured equipment, and through a series of mergers there become fewer companies in the business, and then the larger companies tend to devote their time to building a wall around their interests and not wishing to change products, and I suppose they limit their profits by good taste, maybe as much as anything else. That might surprise someone. And they tend to reduce the number of new products that are brought into the field. And we used to have 9 or 10 or 15 choices of various kinds of equipment. Today you have 3. And these people get together through their trade associations and draw standards for the engineering of these products. And these act to reduce competition, not too much dollar-wise, but they act to reduce competition for the new kind of products. And they are allowed them to design and build and sell and market products that really aren't in the long-term best interest of the country, is the way I see it.
Okay.
Inefficient pieces of equipment that are easy to make.
All right. So you're pointing out something that's very important along the way here, and that is that what monopolists do that's naughty is not only charge prices way above costs, they also tend to produce...
They stifle development.
Yeah, they stifle development.
Because that's expensive, and they keep their costs down.
Right, they stifle development. They provide a poorer range of products. In other words, they do anything that is in their interest, and they aren't goaded into doing what is in the consumer's interest.
Well, let me give you one. I worked for a company that was part of a bona fide monopoly for a number of years. They were sued by the government for antitrust in 1959. Three companies controlled 95% of the market. And
is this air conditioners?
It was the temperature control. It's Johnson Service, Minneapolis Honeywell, and Powers Regulator. They were sued in federal court in Minneapolis, and they pleaded nolle contendere and were fined, I think, $50,000 apiece, and no one ever brought additional suits against them to recover the damages. Well, Johnson Service had in their thermostat a little relay. It was called the model relay. It was the heart of their control system. It was patented in 1919, and it was used continuously until 1960. Unchanged. Nothing new, nothing developed, a big, heavy brass piece of expensive equipment that was tough to make. And because they didn't have any reason to do it. Nothing, no reason. It was a terribly inefficient thing. It had about 6 pounds of brass in it, and then 3 years later, they were producing, when they had to get competitive, because all things changed, other people got on the market, then they had to come out and produce things out of much more efficient materials that were less expensive to build, weren't so expensive to sell, and that was an example of what maybe 40 years of non-competition do. You just don't change your product.
Okay. What does some of the rest of you think? Has the problem gotten worse? He suggests that through mergers, the number of firms, the number of competitors in various industries, like the temperature control gadget industry, has gone down. How about other industries? Has this happened in food?
You're restricting the conversation to economic power. You're not talking about what big corporations do to personalities, what they do with international relations.
Yeah, I'd like to wait with that. See, that's why my last question was, are there other forms of power that don't have to do with market power that we ought to be concerned about? Mm-hmm.
When products get more complicated, it's difficult for a lot of people to judge how good such a product is. And that's where advertising comes in. A lot of times what advertising does is convinces people that they have something that's, you know, the state of the art, the best that they can possibly have. And sometimes it's like he was mentioning, and, you know, really an ancient piece of equipment where far better designs could be made today for far less cost. And one of the problems with a lot of products today, a lot of things we use are very complicated. Most people don't understand how they work and are only convinced through advertising or through blurbs put out by the company. Even people who are informed, scientists and people who really are informed, have to take the word of the manufacturer a lot.
And so this gives sellers substantial power over consumers. All right, that's raising another very important point, the problem of information. You know, one of the things that gives you options is knowledge, is information. You know, remember that example, I used the example of you had a crying baby and the only store that offered milk was open at this hour, and so you had to go there and maybe pay $1.25 a quart. Well, now, you would have, even if it hadn't been the only store in the neighborhood, if you hadn't known there was another one, it wouldn't have done any good. Now, we're in that situation with a lot of products. You know, when I take my car to have it fixed, I just don't know who's a good mechanic. As gadgets become increasingly complex, the seller, who of course knows much more about the gadgets than we do, he may have a substantial informational advantage over us. So we may get took and never know we've been took.
I think that same kind of complexity has acted to reduce the number of people in the market. When you think of the automobile industry, it used to be you could plunk a simple six-cylinder engine under the hood and have a relatively simple drivetrain and some stuff. You had a car that most people wanted. And through a variety of factors, whether we were convinced that we needed all this stuff or our standard of living said we had to have air conditioning and environmental controls and all the rest. But by the time you get that complex package all put together in about the same space that you used to have, the number of companies and people that can produce that technology at the price we're willing to pay, or convinced that we're willing to pay, has narrowed down to some degree.
So the complexity of many products, you're saying, has encouraged the disappearance of competitors. So it's fewer firms.
In other words,
making
I can't in my garage put together a car and market it that people want. It takes more technology than I can do.
Mm-hmm.
I think we as a society encourage this merging sort of thing, though, because we want low prices. And when companies get together and they can cut down on a lot of the costs that it would take to run more individual things, they can market their thing at a lower price, and we go for it. And if there's a Kmart or some other kind of discount store, we think we can get a pretty comparable product, we're going to zero in there to that big company that's got chains all over the country rather than to go to the local businessman who handles maybe almost the same thing, only a few dollars more because he's got a smaller operation going. So we really want that too, because, you know, we'll go to Penny's if we can get what we want rather than go down to the locally owned clothing store for a pair of jeans or a shirt or whatever. And we'll go to the big grocery store chains rather than the local grocery store because we can save a few cents. So don't you think we're really encouraging that as a people too?
Well, I think we are encouraging efficiency. And to the extent to which efficiency is related to size, we're encouraging size. In other words, you know, a lot of people say, oh, what's happened to small business? But they don't patronize it because they go after the bargains.
That, yeah. You know,
but I think you must be careful here. You mentioned the example of grocery stores. It isn't true that the chains always have an advantage over the locally owned grocery stores. There are lots of local chains. The chains are just found in one area, perhaps one area of the country, sometimes just in one city. Somebody will own three or four stores, and they are quite capable of competing with Safeway. And today, they're capable of beating A&P and Kroger. A&P, you know, is foundering badly. And A&P is very large. It's no longer the largest. And it's soon not even going to be the second largest as it begins to spin off and cut its operations in some states. So the having chains all over the country doesn't necessarily give you a cost advantage.
No, but I think we look for that.
Well, but what we're looking for is low cost.
Right.
And I think it's a serious mistake we sometimes make is to assume that the bigger a firm gets, the more it can reduce its costs. And there have been a lot of studies in this area. The general conclusion of the people who made these studies is that for the most part, the public exaggerates the importance of size to efficiency.
But somehow they've gotten us to believe that, so that we, you know, patronize those.
I wonder who's gotten us to believe that. I don't know. Maybe the big corporations have. But somebody, go ahead.
I ran across an interesting article in the June issue of Consumer Reports, entitled "The New Monopolies: How They Affect Consumer Prices." And one paragraph here says that, according to a complaint by the Federal Trade Commission, for example, consumers pay 15-20% too much for breakfast cereals because three companies, Kellogg's, General Mills, and General Foods, control 82% of the market. Other potential cereal producers, it is alleged, are effectively kept out of the cereal market because they can't compete against the enormous advertising campaigns of the big three, which spend 20% of gross sales promoting their products.
Mm-hmm.
And
this is take that one. That's a good example. Now, can I just comment on that? First of all, remember that an FTC complaint doesn't mean anybody's guilty. An FTC complaint doesn't even mean that it's happened. FTC complaints are created by lawyers and economists and people out in the field whose business it is to generate complaints. And they often generate complaints that are subsequently thrown out by the FTC itself. And
lawyers,
sometimes...
Smaller companies who want to get into the market.
Pardon?
Lawyers of smaller companies who want to get into the market.
Large your response.
Lawyers of companies, smaller companies, the main breakfast.
Oh. Well, some of them are just people with there are some people who go to work for the FTC or other antitrust divisions of the government who just have a passion for small business. They're populists, sort of. And they really think that that the big business is getting dangerous, and they're a little bit, well, they really have a nose for any kind of evidence like that, that cereal prices are 15% higher than they would have to be.
But you'd have to say also, Paul, because it's thrown out by the FTC doesn't mean it isn't true.
That's true, sure. Yeah. But if you study FTC cases for a long time, you have very little confidence either way.
Okay.
There's another section here entitled Oligopoly versus Competition. And it says, the three great merger waves occurred at the turn of the century, from 1925 to 1929, and during the 60s. Between 1962 and 1965, every 10 of the 500 largest industrial firms disappeared in mergers. Between 1948 and 1968, some 1,200 manufacturing companies, each with assets of 10 million or more, were merged with other firms.
Mm-hmm. All right, so that's evidence, that would be evidence that the problem is getting worse, wouldn't it? Because we've gone through three merger waves since the turn of the century. One right at the turn of the century when U.S. Steel was put together and a number of other large combinations. And another one in the 20s and then one more recently in the last decade.
For example, U.S. Steel announcing a price increase of 6% on many major products. And within 2 days, all the other firms increased their prices by an identical amount.
Yeah, but now careful, because first of all, notice that U.S. Steel, when it was put together in 1903, had over 50% of steelmaking capacity, and it's now down to, I believe, a little less than 20%. In other words, U.S. Steel's share of the market has steadily declined. Another reason for being suspicious of that statement is that, look, pricing steel products is an extremely complicated search process. You know, there's no way in which you can look at a piece of steel and look out the window and decide what its price ought to be. Price searching for steel products, which are very complex and which are extremely coordinated processes, is a difficult business. And so companies have to search for a price structure that will maximize their profits. Now, the bigger the company, the lower will be its search costs per unit of product sold. Consequently, large firms tend to invest more in market research than do small firms. And small firms frequently follow the big firm simply because the big firm has more of an incentive to do the looking. It's really the same kind of thing you would do. You're looking for a state park and you can't find it. And what you do is you follow the people with local license plates and trailers on the assumption that they're more likely to get there. You want to say something? No?
I don't know. There's a lot of things in the
article. Yeah.
Does merger in itself indicate any kind of monopoly or absence of competition?
All right. Let me speak to that question. There are three kinds of mergers. They tend to blur together sometimes, but they're conceptually reasonably distinct. There is the horizontal merger. When U.S. Steel put together, when J.P. Morgan put together a whole bunch of steel producers who were, you know, producing final steel products, that was a horizontal merger. If you put together a whole bunch of grocery stores into one store, that's a horizontal merger. You're putting together firms that were directly competing with one another. The vertical merger occurs when you put together suppliers and users of those supplies. For example, Henry Ford had this crazy vision. It cost him a lot of money. It's inefficient. But he was going to produce an automobile from the iron ore up in the Mesabi Range all the way to the, you know, to the dealer's window. And so you've got the River Rouge plant. And the Ford company owned iron ore and ore boats and a steel plant all the way from the furnaces to the final products. And you can tour it. It's a marvelous thing to tour. It's terribly inefficient. General Motors was shrewd. It bought its steel from specialists rather than trying to produce it itself. But anyway, this is a vertical merger. Now, you would expect to see some different competitive effects, wouldn't you? Horizontal mergers seem to be exactly the kind of thing we don't want to see, because horizontal mergers reduce the number of alternatives buyers have. And consequently, the law, federal law, is quite clear. I'm not saying that it's always well enforced, but the law now says that firms may not merge, that's the Clayton Act, firms may not merge when the effect is substantially to lessen competition. And horizontal mergers are looked at by the Attorney General's office with a very jaundiced eye. There was actually a big loophole in the law until 1950, and that's what permitted the merger movement of the first merger movement took place in the first decade of this century. Then the Clayton Act was passed in 1914, Congress closing the barn door after the horses escaped. But how do you know that you should close the barn door until a few horses have gotten out? Then it turned out that there was a big loophole in it, And in the 1920s, the firms drove through. That's a technical loophole, but they closed it in 1950. And since that time, I would say that the federal government has done a quite adequate job, quite vigilant and adequate job in preventing horizontal mergers. It is extremely difficult for a firm of any size in an industry that doesn't have lots of other producers to merge with any of its competitors. You go to the Attorney General's office and these guys are very negative about it, and they put the burden of proof on the merger. And you can, if you don't believe the opinion, the Attorney General's office, in other words, will usually give the opinion that they don't like it, which means that if you go ahead and do it, you're at least going to have to bear the costs of a suit. And so they often say, forget it. Vertical mergers, not as clear. Does that do vertical mergers reduce competition? In what way would they? Safeway acquires a dairy company, is that reducing competition? Well, the argument is, yeah, it may, because Safeway will now make all of its purchases of milk from its own dairy. The trouble with that is that why would Safeway do that if its own dairy weren't able to give it the milk at lower cost? There are cases.
Sounds like that would be cutting costs more than anything.
Well, the argument is that it is sometimes a way of trying to cut costs. There are all kinds of reasons that I will get to in a moment with conglomerate mergers. But there are cases where firms have bought their suppliers and then continued to purchase from alternative suppliers because they weren't satisfied with the products that they were getting from their own suppliers. General Motors, for years was controlled by the DuPont interests and yet did not buy all of its waxes and products produced by DuPont from DuPont. These decisions are often made by managers at a lower level who don't give a rip. They don't even know in any meaningful sense that the company that they work for is also owns some other company over there. All they see is that's a company that produces products that don't quite fit my process, and I'm concerned about the profits in my division. However, there obviously is room for abuse. In any event, there doesn't seem to be much evidence that competition is substantially diminished by vertical mergers. Moreover, vertical mergers aren't occurring too much, and the principal opposition usually comes from small businesses who attack vertical mergers or anything that they can call a vertical merger on the ground that it's an attempt on the part of the big companies to take them over. The big discount houses and the chain stores are viewed as monopolists on the prowl. There's a very strong small business movement that tries to get laws passed that restrict the ability of chain stores and discount houses to operate. The whole fair trade practice business, which I think Congress is about to repeal. Back in 1937, Congress authorized the states to pass laws that would enable manufacturers and little retailers to get together and set minimum prices below which chain stores and discount houses could not go. And the states jumped into the breach. Almost every state in the union passed such a law, and they're called fair trade laws. But they've gotten into all sorts of legal trouble, and they've proved too difficult to enforce, and the competitors have proved too ingenious. That is the principal reason why you find some stores around the country. You only get into them with a card, a special card. That way they get around the fair trade laws. There are all sorts of gadgets that are used. And so there are some discounters who simply, they went ahead, violated the fair trade laws, and figured they could make enough profits to pay for the costs of the suit. And they also knew that they were very popular with customers, that when they were sued, they would get a lot of publicity. As a price cutter, people would come flooding in. So anyway, they're collapsing. But
maybe this is where we have gotten the idea that they're so cheap. You said you wondered how we got.
Right.
Just what you're saying.
Little businesses suing chain stores on the grounds that they're monopolists and using as evidence the fact that the chain store charges low prices. okay. Yeah, Jerry.
This same type of thing, what she was. It also promotes mediocrity in everything we buy, from a car to a sandwich. Because if a company, a large one, small one, or whatever, can advertise a product that looks like a more expensive product, but for less money, they'll sell it. And they'll make as much profit as the guy that's selling the high-priced model that really is a better product. You see, so we get
always
products that will usually. And so we get products that'll wear out in a few years. And we'll say, well, boy, they don't make things like they used to. And when it's our own feelings that we, whether it's through advertising or our own background in society, it says, well, we should always try to buy the cheaper products because we're saving money or what. Mm-hmm. But in my experience in selling things, it's still very competitive in some areas. Like I was selling flavoring. And man, if your manufacturing plant isn't, I'm from the LA area, and if your manufacturing plant isn't in LA, you have to creep. I was trying to sell a product that was made in Dallas. Well, all the spices and everything came from the West Indies, the spice house. And they came into LA and they had to be shipped to Dallas and they had to be shipped, processed and shipped back to LA. Well, that freight was killing me because these people had to watch their pennies, literally. And even the processors put out a mediocre product. Even though they could make better flavors, they can make a real good strawberry flavor or something. Strawberry is a flavor that's gone down since it was introduced, and all the other flavors. Barbecue flavor, they use a lot of salt because salt is cheaper than the flavors that would make it really taste good.
Don't people learn?
Well, people won't buy the expensive product.
Well, because they're making a trade-off between quality and price.
That's right.
Well, they got a right to do that. I do that. I buy a Volkswagen. I do not buy a Rolls Royce.
Because you're satisfied with the Volkswagen.
Yeah. And I buy a lot of cheap things because I buy cheap combs because I lose them.
Yeah. But then
that's your problem.
Yeah, but I don't want an expensive one if I'm going to lose it, you know.
Right.
But I'll lose it before it wears out.
It's that sort of thing also stifles progress, creativity. If people won't buy the expensive product, there's no use in making it. So you get a mediocre product, you get a mediocre stereo, you get a mediocre car, and maybe you want to buy one, but because people won't buy them as much, people won't make them as much. People won't make them as much, it costs more to make them per unit.
Yeah, well, maybe, do you think the economy ought to be run in such a way as to stimulate the creative impulses of producers, or should it?
I think there's room for that. There should be.
Well, you can be creative in your buying. I agree with him. There are some things that you buy cheap because you might lose them or you just, it's something you might not need that often. For example, if I walk into a store, I wouldn't walk into JCPenney's to buy a stereo. I know a lot of people do, but my creative imagination says, I know enough about sound and I wouldn't even think of going there to buy stereo equipment. So I'd have to go to a place that's higher expense, but to get the quality equipment, you have to do that. But everybody's different, you know? Some people are satisfied with junk products, you know?
A lot of people don't even know any better because all they hear is, you know, realistic, you know, or, you know, electrophonic and different things like that. And I wonder why they aren't satisfied with the product until they go to some friend's house and pay, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 for their system. And when really, it doesn't cost that much to make that kind of equipment. You know, I work for a stereo company.
Some things do cost, some things don't. I mean, I think it's very difficult to generalize in this area. There are 5 minutes for 7 minutes before Dave's going to blow the whistle on me, and I was not finished with the merger business and the most important merger in our time I haven't mentioned. I'd like to go back to that if I may for just a moment. The kinds of mergers that characterize the 60s are the conglomerate mergers. These are, you know, conglomerates. You put together a company that makes shoe polish and one that produces clothing and refrigerators, and so you've gotten the growth of these giant conglomerates, Litton, Ling Temco bought Transamerica, and of course, almost every large corporation now is beginning to do it. The cigarette companies have gone heavily in for what they call diversification, because they're a little bit scared that the cigarette business might collapse. And so Philip Morris owns lumber companies and I don't know what all else. Now, the conglomerate, most of the mergers of the 60s were conglomerate mergers. Do conglomerate mergers reduce competition? That's the question on which there is a lot of difference of opinion. But I figured this question would come up, so I jotted down some anticipating questions here. I jotted down some things to be remembered. That first of all, little businesses will usually object to conglomerate mergers, and so the amount of noise that is generated during a conglomerate merger is not a good indication of the threat to the economy. There's a difference, you know, between reducing competition and reducing competitors. When the little businessman says, "I can't compete, protect me," he's going to the government to say, "Stop competition. Don't let competition happen because it hurts me. Make the consumer pay for my inefficiency." Then a serious problem many people worry about with conglomerates is that they are able to conceal too much information, that they put together these consolidated income statements, and investors don't know which industry is doing well and which one isn't. They can engage in, they can purchase internally, and you don't know at what prices they're purchasing. So it's very difficult for the public to ride herd on their performance. They're just such big, they're closed operations. You don't know what's going on, and investors don't know how to evaluate them either. Another argument is the political power argument. That, well, maybe conglomerates don't increase market power, but gee whiz, look at all the clout, the political clout that they have. Another one is the financial shenanigans argument. That is, that conglomerates are really put together in order to bilk gullible investors. And in some cases, that's clearly true. I think it's clearly true. Dallas has, an outstanding gentleman in this line, James Ling, who put together Ling Temco Vought, and he was really a shrewd manipulator. In the public, the public was buying Jim Ling. They said anything he touches turns to gold. So if he merges an apple farm with a tennis racket, buy shares in it. But eventually he overreached himself. The problem is people were discounting the future and the hereafter, and eventually it collapsed. But by golly, no sooner collapsed than he'd been driven out, and he put together a new one called Omega Alpha. And the public started buying like crazy, and up that went. And it just collapsed. But I'm sure that if he tried something new. But there are a lot of these financial shenanigans. These shenanigans, however, are based on, they're not really shenanigans. They're based on the fact that one corporation will have a lot of liquid assets and the other corporation will have a lot of opportunities but be short of capital, and it's complex. And our laws make some of these things possible too. And then there's the investor control argument. A lot of people say that the real problem with corporations, the big corporations today, is not that they have so much power, but that power isn't under the control of the owners. That the managers control these corporations, and the managers form an automatic self-perpetuating oligarchy, to use A.A. Burley's phrase. That's a pretty bad collection of terms. An automatic self-perpetuating oligarchy. Now, who chooses the people who run General Motors? You say the shareholders. Baloney. Shareholders vote for the people whom the board of directors put on the slate. And who do the board of directors put on the slate? Well, I don't know. Themselves and some of their number. Well, now, but who, then you say, but who elects the board of directors? The shareholders, yeah. But the candidates are chosen by the executive officers. So the executive officers choose the board of directors. The board of directors choose the executive officers. And who's really controlling this? Well, the fear is that conglomerates make that whole problem worse. On the other hand, two nice things to say about conglomerates. They may be a way of increasing investor control over management. Because if management is doing a bad job from the standpoint of the owners, then if management is doing a bad job there is an incentive for somebody big enough with the financial resources to move in, buy controlling interest, throw the bad managers out, put in good management, let the stock price go up, and make profit. And conglomerates have been doing that. And in the process, have been scaring the pants off a lot of inefficient, self-serving managers. So this turns out to be a way of giving the investors greater control over their corporation. There's nothing that inefficient managers fear like a raid. The other thing is that...
It gives the investors control.
Yeah, it does. It gives the investor better guarantees that the management will function in his interest. In other words, that it will operate to maximize the present value of the stock, which I take to be the interest of the investor. Sure, it doesn't give him participatory democracy.
I don't have a thing to say about those big fights that are going on.
No, that's not the point. When I say give the investor control, I don't mean, I'll make this clear, I don't mean that we now have some kind of participatory democracy going. No, what I mean is it gets managers to behave in the interest of shareholders.
Yeah, the market functions in such a way that somebody else moved in with another management idea.
Right, but the point I'm making, and it's not the point you're interested in, maybe, but the point I'm making is that gets management to function more in the stockholder's interest. Because the fear was that, Burley's fear, was that managers being beyond the control of shareholders might maximize their own utility instead of the welfare of stockholders.
Most of the investors who are important are the great big corporations, great big insurance funds and so forth. I mean, it's a very oligarchical kind of investor that's involved, who pulls investment out. It's still a part of a whole great thing.
Right, so there's some kind of a power structure there. But I want to mention one other point, and then we'll go to this or Dave's question, and that is that one of the ways in which competition is effective is through its threat. It may not be there. But if sellers are afraid it may come, they will behave differently than they would behave if they don't have to fear potential competition. And conglomerates are ways of creating, increasing the threat of potential competition. You know, if you say, for example, that in these temperature control gadgets, there are just three firms producing them, and they've done a very bad job, they've gotten together. Then I would say, well, gee, if they're making such big profits, presumably the reason they're not diversifying the product and improving the product is because it would cost them more than it's worth. So they must be making bigger profits than they would make if they competed. Well, why doesn't somebody come in there then and make a better profit and drive them out of business? And one of the
answers
is...
Exactly what happened. They killed themselves because Reynolds backed the Robert Shaw division, right, and they went into business. Coleman went into business. Two other people are now the business.
And who backed them? And who backed them?
Oh, bigger companies.
Right, bigger companies. So that's one of the advantages.
It looks so good.
Right. They've got the big companies have the financial resources. The standard answer to that used to be, well, the reason other firms won't come in is it requires too much capital. But these large conglomerates have that kind of capital. And so they...
I didn't get that all that he said. How do they support that?
They provided the financing.
They want to keep them separate, you mean, or not?
No. They provided financing for new firms to enter and start competing.
Yeah. We make a pacemaker, and we're a small company. We have 65% of the business in the United States, and something like 70-some percent in the rest of the world, a heart pacemaker. But GE went into the business, and they're falling all over themselves, General Electric. And they did invest a lot. That seems, how do you account for that?
Well, that just shows that being big doesn't always make you better.
Yeah.
But being big does give you the resources to move in where you're pretty sure that you know how to be better. The point is not that big firms are more efficient. The point I was making here is that large firms have command over capital resources, risk capital, that can move in to take advantage of situations where products are not being produced efficiently and at low cost.
Or where it looks like they can make a lot of money.
Well, it comes to the same. They don't move in order to do good. I assume they move in to make money. It's 11:30, and I wanted to be sure we get back to this question, which I think is a question that Al was antsy about too. There are lots of questions. I don't know how far we're going to get before the bell rings or before you get afraid that you won't be first in line or second in line run out. And I want to assure you that I do not think that we have tapped more than 33% of the problems of corporate power. there's a lot more here, and I don't want to give the impression that I think the rather narrow considerations to which I'm trying to direct your attention are the whole of the problem. I think they're an important part of the problem, and that perhaps getting clearer than people usually are in this area will help us to understand the dimensions of the problems in other areas. But now, Dave, can you raise your question again?
Well, I think in my mind, it's probably answered some of it. But my question was, why does, if in fact we can't prove that there's been any real objective change, it hasn't gotten that much worse, why does it seem that way to so many people? And it looks to me that, speaking personally, it may be that it seems worse to me that I'm more aware now than I was when I was younger. I had my nose in books, and I was provided for by my parents. I didn't pay attention to it. Maybe at that time there were other things that attracted the newspapers more. You know, there were several wars involved and other things, and an atmosphere of prosperity, so that this was covered up. There are reasons why maybe in my maturity, others' maturity, perhaps to be more aware of the fact that there always is a problem, always has been this healing. The second thing sounds like it's education. I mean, you've educated me to some degree this morning. The discussion has educated me. And what I've taken away from this last couple of hours is that indeed, there may well be no greater problem than there ever was. There may be cyclical problem. There was a cycle that built up to an antitrust law, and then build up now. There may be the conglomerates are going to go too far, and there'll be something to try to control them. And maybe it's just a case of education that's going to make us more aware of the fact that things are no different than they ever were. And in other words, we're yelling about something we don't know anything about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's correct. But there's also a possibility that there are aspects of the problem of power, corporate power, economic power, which we haven't mentioned, which we haven't thought of. And I think there are some people here who have some things in mind along this line. But give me a chance to get a quick shot. You said, since things haven't gotten worse, that hasn't been proved. But there's one piece of evidence I would at least like you to be aware of. You were talking about mergers, and you were talking about the smaller number of firms, and we're all aware of the fact that in many industry after industry we can think of, there are now fewer firms than there were 20 years ago, and fewer 20 years ago than there were 50 years ago. Well, the Census Bureau, the manufacturing census, compiles regular data on industrial concentration. What they do is they calculate the percentage of the total market for some product that is controlled by the four largest firms and then the eight largest firms. They don't break it down in less than four because that would violate the Census Bureau's obligation to preserve anonymity. So four and sometimes eight becomes the standard measure of industrial concentration. So what they do is if in 1900, 4% of the firms controlled 32% of the market, and in 1970, four firms, the largest four firms controlled 80%, then clearly industrial concentration has gone up. You understand with that? What percentage of the market do the four largest firms have? All right, now, these data are available. They're quite reliable. There's a fishy character to them in that who knows what a market is, You're talking about the steel market, but the problem is a steel producer on the West Coast does not really produce to compete too much with one in Baltimore, Maryland, at least not with steel girders. So then there's another problem, too. You say there are only two firms producing cans, but then is the can industry a separate industry, or you should merge that with the bottle industry? So, because products in different industries do compete with one another, nobody really knows quite what these industrial concentration ratios mean. But one thing we do know is that they have not increased since 1900. At least they haven't increased significantly. Because some have gone up and some have gone down. And how do you average apples and oranges, or apples and hair tonic? But there have been several very, very comprehensive and well-criticized empirical studies on it. And the conclusion of them all is that industrial concentration ratios have not changed significantly. They've probably gone down a little bit overall. Now, that's an important piece of fact to keep in mind. So when somebody says, oligopolies and monopolies are taking over, everybody's merging, say, not everybody. Somebody ain't.
I just have one quick question.
Yeah.
I'm kind of in the dark, so I'll just throw it out. Talking about companies that have a lot of power and a lot of capital, like you're talking about, or larger corporations, I had a friend of mine that was telling me about Litton Industries, how much money they have. And he said it is astronomical how much money they have to work with. To me, as an individual, I'm lost. I can't even fathom what kind of power they have. I mean, what are we talking about here? You know, it's just like the government. I mean, I don't know what the CIA is doing. I mean, how do you find out? We know they have money. What are they doing with their money? You know, for me, it's a discreet thing. The board of directors aren't just going to, you know, hand you a list and say, well, this is what we're doing with our dough. I mean, it's like you're kind of in the dark.
I have a friend on the board of directors of Litton, and he says the thing they're doing most with the money is losing it.
The issue is what do they do in losing it.
Yeah. What bothers you when you talk about power, economic power, corporate power?
Well, a number of things, but let's just get some very concrete. The contributions are now turned up to the political party.
Okay.
It bothers me because it indicates if they make all those contributions and they have to go to such lengths to make them, you know, it's fantastic. They've got some foreign company. It would be a fantastic operation. Terms of how they conceal that stuff. Why did they make the contribution?
Wait a minute, are you talking about the bribes overseas or the bribes?
I'm talking about the bribes. They went overseas to get their foreign corporations to put the money down in some way or other so that they could have the money to give to the national political party, chiefly Republican.
Okay, so you're talking about contributions to American political parties.
Right.
And
plenty that's gone on overseas.
Okay,
yeah. It's worse, I think.
Now,
but what does that mean?
What does that mean?
Why do they do it?
Well, you know, they've...
It's the smoke that really bothers me because they are able to do it and I'm not able to do it.
I think it's clear why they've done it. There are enough of the executives who participated in this and not talked about it, but I think it's clear why they did it. They didn't figure they would get caught. It had been going on for a long time. It was not their money, you know. It bought them a little prestige and, you know.
See, I figure if they aren't getting favors for it, they're not going to give money. I know that sometimes they don't get any favors for money. Lots of times they figure they have to. It's a kind of a guarantee that a certain philosophy of government or something will. But certainly, the CIO, AFL, and the corporation, and the Pentagon are the operations that have the money to do all kinds of things in terms of supporting candidates, at least giving them money so they can win their election. I mean, so they can have the money to operate an election. So that all kinds of informational processes can get started. And John Q. Citizen, as a public, really has a great difficulty. Now, Vietnam is one of the few illustrations when the public somehow create an opposition to the industrial military high governmental complex in terms of its decisions for certain reasons. And that really bugs me that you've got that complex. If it decides on something, it's got such power and control over communication, all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's true that between the lines of New York Times, you could have read everything that's in the Best and the Brightest by David Hamilton. But we didn't know that. That wasn't a part of the public knowledge. It was just in between the lines.
But it wasn't a part of the knowledge of corporate executives either. Surely you don't think it was. You don't think that even the executives in defense industries, defense or war-related industries, you don't think that they knew all the stuff that was in Halberstam's Best and the Brightest, do you?
No, I don't think they did.
I don't think. I don't believe that they...
The war industries had a natural interest in doing what was being done.
Well, sure. Just like cigarette industries have a natural...
Whenever there's a war, it seems to me that... They are not going to be on the side of trying to stop them.
Of course not. I don't expect that. You know, I do not expect Boeing and in General Dynamics to be militantly passive.
They have the instrument to stop something else if they don't want, if they don't like it. And it's over against the public. They have such tremendous resources.
You think they do?
No.
I don't. I am not impressed with the influence of large corporations in government. I'm impressed the other way. I'm impressed by how vulnerable they are.
It depends upon whether their interests and the interests of those big, you know, the high-level government officials and the Pentagon coincide.
Ah, but that's a different matter.
When they coincide, there's really...
Yeah, but now suppose that the interests of the high-level government officials and the Pentagon coincided and the interests of these large corporations was something different. Would it make any difference? In other words, what difference does the interests of these large corporations make in the decisions of government? And I'm just not sure that it makes a whole lot of difference at all.
Well, I think generally they have for the most part, their interests coincide, and they seem to be somewhat opposed to my interests as a human being.
Well, all right, but now, see, now you've got a funny hypothesis here, because you're blaming the corporations for something, and you're admitting, or you're saying either that if they disappeared, the situation wouldn't change, or that there's no way of testing whether, if the corporations disappeared, the situation would change. And that's not a very useful hypothesis.
No, I'm just saying that this time in history, the results of the market system, the way it functions, and the way in which the interests of the corporation and the Pentagon and people who have to get elected to office, that it coincides, or it is much worse than it used to be because of what it's about. And it was about more or less the same thing before, but it's much, we ought to be about what that results in much less than we are now.
All right, but it's very important to understand, I think, what's going on and what's really moving government, because if you believe, as I do, that the real danger is the federal government, and that the federal government, in fact, controls our national life and mucks it up, and that almost everything that goes wrong in the economy finds the federal government with an enormous finger in the pie, if you believe that, you're going to move in a quite different direction from the direction which you can move if you think the government is under control of corporations.
Well, I think everything is under the control of an ideology and of a value structure that is kind of demonic. And so it's very difficult for us because all of the resources are involved in the perpetuation of that ideology. It's really difficult to know how you're going to penetrate it all.
I think an example of what he's talking about is that Glenn L. Martin, who used to be in Denver, just before the Second World War, Martin Corporation became Martin Marietta in Georgia. But they told the legislators of Georgia that they were going to move there, and that ever since the Georgia legislators have seen to it that they do get into the committees, like the Armed Services Committee and such, and those men have been influenced very much by the fact that they've got a great big factory in Georgia that produces military equipment.
Yes, but see, now they have to compete with the legislators from Fort Worth who do the same thing for General Dynamics and the people from Washington who are on the side of Boeing. The point is that these defense contractors do not have, sure they have their state congressional delegations behind them and they manage to get a lot of inside government clout, but they have to fight one another. And my goodness, you certainly remember how when contracts are awarded to General Dynamics and not to Boeing, they're screaming galore. Now, you could argue, of course, that the combined effect of all their interests is simply to increase the size of the federal budget for wartime expenditures. But here you run against the fact that over the last 10 years, federal expenditures for military purposes have dramatically declined.
Yeah. In percentage-wise, isn't that a lot because...
In real terms, right. I'm going to be careful. In percentage terms, as a percentage of the federal budget, the federal government is spending substantially less today as a percentage of its total budget on military purposes than it was 10 years ago. And in real dollar terms, in other words, if you adjust the dollar for changes in the price, in the value of the dollar, federal government expenditures for military purposes have also declined significantly over the last 10 years.